So again, welcome and thank y'all for joining us today. And we'll get started with the DWC quarterly update. We have a few items on the agenda. As I mentioned, the commissioner will be welcoming us a little bit later today. But we will go ahead and get through the DWC staffing changes. And again, the commissioner will be able to fill us in on some of the staffing changes. Erica De La Cruz, who is our new deputy commissioner for claims and customer services, was not able to attend today. So he's going to go through the changes for her area at that time. So we're going to go ahead and kick things off then with Mary Landrum, our new deputy commissioner for health and safety.
Thank you, Kate. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mary Landrum. I'm the deputy commissioner for health and safety. But before I talk about my area, I'd like to first give thanks to Matt Zurich for his service to the state of Texas. Some of you may not know, but he retired at the end of October after 15 years of state service. He left some pretty big shoes to fill, given all he accomplished during this time at DWC. Among some of his accomplishments, and in no specific order, were the 2008 fee guidelines, the pharmacy formulary, the medical quality review process, accident prevention services rules, Comm Connection, and the elimination of the medical fee dispute backlog. In addition to these accomplishments, succession planning was a priority for him. He often said that organizations take on the characteristics of their leaders, and he was right about that. He set the example for this through his daily actions. In essence, he walked the talk. He ensured that at his departure, a strong team of leaders were left to steer the ship, leaders who are knowledgeable, experienced, and committed to do the right thing and what is best for our system. So while there is still work left to be done, I do have a whole crew ready to help steer the ship in the right direction. But before taking on this new role, some of you may know that I held the position of Director for Healthcare Business Management and Designated Doctor Operations. So health and safety today includes all that was already under my umbrella with the addition of medical fee dispute resolution and workplace safety. In addition to that, the entire program, it's also coming under my umbrella, given the fact that something that may be new to you today is that Joe is retiring at the end of this year. So as a result of that, I'm also assuming responsibility for the DD program. So I also like to thank Joe for his 25 years of service and leadership. Joe's career has been focused on management, business process analysis, and state agency administration within TDI, DWC, and SORM. As Deputy Commissioner for Business Process, Joe has been responsible for the division's claim file and electronic records, management functions, the Designated Doctor Program, information management services, business process improvement, and DWC's enterprise automation planning. But most recently, Joe led the charge of two significant DD rule projects that are ongoing today. And you will hear a little bit more about those rule projects from Joe here in just a bit. So what does health and safety look like? So as you all know, DWC monitors the delivery of medical benefits and the quality of care provided in our system to ensure that injured employees have access to prompt, high-quality, cost-effective medical care appropriate to their work-related injuries. So this is done through the Office of the Medical Advisor. And Dr. Graves Owen is our medical advisor and the head of OMA, as we like to refer to that program. And through that, he monitors the quality of healthcare by conducting evidence-based medical quality reviews of healthcare providers and other system participants. Dr. Owen also recommends to Commissioner Nelson rules and policies regarding medical care and medical delivery systems and determines which doctors meet the qualifications to serve as designated doctors. The work that's performed in OMA is done with the assistance of the Medical Quality Review Panel, or MQRP, as we like to refer to them. And the MQRP is comprised of 60 healthcare practitioners that assist Dr. Owen in the medical quality review process. Then also, we have another program area called healthcare development. And this is led by Chris Bogley, who was recently promoted to director, This program area researches and analyzes economic factors and treatment protocols that form the basis for advising the commissioner regarding development of healthcare-related rules and guidelines for medical fees, medical treatments, return to work, and impairment ratings. This program is critical in ensuring DWC stays current with healthcare issues that are happening nationwide and their impact to our system, if any. Then healthcare business management, which provides, regulates, and facilitates activities in the areas of healthcare quality review, healthcare provider outreach, and return to work outreach. That's one of the program areas that fell under me. And that role, that director role, is a role that I'm looking to hire hopefully here soon. And so basically healthcare quality review, that's the program that supports the functional operation of the Office of the Medical Advisor. And the healthcare provider outreach provides internal and external training on medical benefits, as well as educational outreach efforts to encourage non-participating healthcare providers to become involved in the in our system. Then you also have return to work outreach, which provides outreach and educations to employers, carriers, healthcare providers, and injured employees on the value and benefits of injured employees returning to productive roles in the workplace after an injury. Medical fee dispute resolution. That program is led by Greg Arden, who is the director. And most of you, I'm sure, know that MFDR processes and resolves reimbursement disputes related to compensable and medically necessary non-network healthcare services that have already been provided. And I like to kind of think about MFDR that they're the program that issue well-written, detailed decisions to explain to parties the outcome of a dispute. The decision serves as a roadmap for parties and helps in the dispute process, specifically when decisions are appealed to the next level. And then we have the designated doctor program. So DWC certifies designated doctors who must complete the required training and testing. But this process, that actually is handled under the Office of the Medical Advisor. But the rest of the designated doctor activities do fall into two sections, what we refer to as the designated doctor education and designated doctor operations. And the designated doctor education section is led by Dr. Lori Wasserberger, who is our designated doctor advisor. And that program provides education, training, resources, and direction to designated doctors and other system participants to make sure doctors are qualified to evaluate injured employees. And then the designated doctor operations, which is led by Santiago Calderon as the director, they process the request for designated doctor examinations, and they collaborate with other program areas to ensure injured employees understand the designated doctor process and ensure that the examinations take place and examination reports are received. But more importantly, Santiago's team also provides the logistical support to Dr. Wasserberger during the designated doctor certification courses and optional live webinars. So all of that is what makes the health part of my position. The safety part of my position, which is just as critical, is workplace safety, which is led by Director Chris DeMira. And this program provides Texas employers and employees with health and safety resources and services to prevent occupational injuries and illnesses. This program also educates employees and employers about safe and healthy work practices, inspects insurance companies that write workers' compensations in Texas to ensure that they are providing required accident prevention and return to work coordination services to their policyholders, that audits select high-risk employers to confirm that required accident prevention plans have been properly implemented. And they also operate a 24-hour bilingual toll-free hotline to report suspected safety violations. So all of these programs are what make health and safety. And as you can see by the names that I've given you, there is a group of individuals that are quite experienced and tenured. So I'm happy to take this role with the assistance of all those individuals. And so now I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Kim Donovan.
Thank you, Mary. So, hello and good afternoon. For those of y'all that I don't know, my name is Kim Donovan, and I'm the new Deputy Director of Operations and External Relations. So this new area has DWC Communications, it has the Research and Evaluation Group, and it has External and Media Relations. So DWC Communications is led by Melissa Gale, and they're responsible for all communication campaigns for all of our DWC program services. They provide translation services, and then they're also the group that develops and leads DWC's annual education conference events. The second area is Research and Evaluation Group that is led by Botao Shi. And this group has dedicated researchers that are responsible for conducting professional studies on various system issues. So things like cost, quality, and operational effectiveness of the workers' compensation system. And then the last, but certainly not least, is External and Media Relations, which is led by Kate Sidora, who is our host for today's call. And this area manages DWC's government relations, legislative activities, and stakeholder outreach, and also coordinates the responses to the media. So that's a little bit an overview of this new program area. Since I'm new as well, I'll give you a short background on myself. So prior to joining DWC at the beginning of this month, I came from the Office of Public Insurance Counsel, where I served as the Chief Policy Analyst for about 4.5 years. Prior to that, I was with TDI as a manager in the Property and Casualty Lines Office. And then prior to my state service, I did work in the private sector for over 20 years between two large insurance companies in various roles, from a claims adjuster to a national claims compliance manager. So that is a little bit about myself and the new program area. And I appreciate everyone coming today. And again, it's nice to meet you virtually. And now I'll turn it over to Tammy with Business Process. Tammy?
Thank you, Kim, and good afternoon. I am Tammy Campion, and Commissioner Nelson has given me the opportunity to be the next Deputy Commissioner of Business Process. I will be replacing Joe McElrath, who will be retiring in December. And until then, Joe and I will continue to work through the transition. I want to assure you that the quality, service, and responsiveness you've come to expect from Business Process will continue. I have worked for the division for many years, most recently as the Director of Business Process Operations, directing the daily operations and services provided by Information Management Services, Enterprise Automation Services, and Business Process Services. Information Management Services is directed by Russ Harper. Russ is responsible for maintaining a comprehensive database or data warehouse of information reported to the division. This allows us to report on the performance of the workers' comp system, provide data for public information requests, and report on performance and workload measures. Enterprise Automation Services is directed by Martha Loeveno. Martha is responsible for claim and medical billing data reported to the division through Electronic Data Interchange, or EDI. Her area provides project management for DWC's technology and modernization projects, and they provide responsive information for claim record requests and employer coverage verification requests. Business Process Services is directed by Hugo Salazar. Hugo is responsible for the management of DWC's electronic records. His area provides support to customers filing documents through Secure File Transfer Protocol, or SFTP, documents uploaded through the new TexCom portal, or documents received through facsimile. Hugo's area also provides support and management of system participant SFTP boxes. I would like to thank Commissioner Nelson for giving me this opportunity and Joe McElrath for preparing me to serve in this role. Now I will turn it over to Deborah Knight for the compliance and investigation update.
Oh, Deborah, you're on mute.
Well, I just said some really, really smart stuff that everybody missed. So, no. So my name is Deborah Knight, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Compliance and Investigations. And my area consists of the audits and investigations area, the enforcement, fraud investigation, and fraud prosecution. So we'll go ahead and get into our update on those areas. Next slide, please. Okay, so we'll talk about complaints, or really what we're talking about are allegations of administrative violations, because those are complaints that we have authority to do something about. Next slide. So with the complaints for calendar year 2022, we've received 1,839 complaints. Of those complaints, about 70% of those are complaints that we receive from external folks, and the rest of those are internal referrals from other areas within DWC. The let's see, so about 31% of those. We've tried to put these in buckets, because when you look at the 1,839, doesn't really say a whole lot. So we put them in pretty large buckets. Mm-hmm. Of those buckets, communications is obviously the largest number of complaints. Those, we look at those, the top issues that we receive complaints on are failure to timely respond to an injured employee's request on their claim, a failure to notify DDMC of the injured employees or injured employee of an action occurring on a claim within 10 days of taking the action. And third, failure to provide claim services in a sufficient numbers and ensure effective communications with injured employees. So those are the big communication complaints that we receive. The other, what we're talking about, the other number, the 128 other number, these are complaints that we receive, but they don't allege an allegation of the administrative allegation. Usually these are disputes that aren't administrative violations, but should be in this dispute area of what we're looking at with those types of complaints. So we've closed during that calendar year, 1,307 complaints. Of those closed complaints, 291 were confirmed. And what I mean by confirmed is those allegations were investigated and there was a confirmed violation, administrative violation. The 431 were DWC education complaints. So we are statutorily required to investigate based on a risk assessment of the alleged action. And so for those that are those administrative allegations that are considered to be lower risk to the system, those don't get a complete investigation. Rather, they're sent education letters to explain what the requirements are. And 584 were non-confirmed, or it was investigated. So what that means is it was investigated and the complaint was not confirmed as a violation. Next slide. So just a little further breakdown, some of these things about how we're respondent type and what type of where the category of complaint is by respondent type. For insurance carriers, not surprisingly, indemnity benefits, 528 of those complaints were about indemnity of benefits, and 413 were medical benefits. Next slide. So the other area for compliance for audits and investigations is audits. Next slide. So let's talk about our FY 2023 compliance audits. We're scheduled to complete 64 audits during this year. 24 of those will be death benefit, lifetime income benefit audits. 20 of those will be the initial payment of TIBS, and 20 of those will be medical bill processing audits. I know for those of you who've been to this meeting before, I've emphasized the death benefit and life income benefits audits and results that we've continually seen over the years. And I've promised a document. So we have put together a document entitled Common Mistakes Document. We put it on our website in two different places. Here are the links to the two different places where it's found, where the document's found. That doc is not meant to be an all-inclusive treatise or a summary of the labor code and administrative code requirements for common mistakes. Rather, it's meant to be, we're hoping it to be helpful to look at the things that we see pretty consistently that are wrong in the death benefit calculations. We've talked in the past about an average weekly wage statement, which was incorrect on its face, such as that it included weeks after the injured employee had died. And since they weren't at work, they weren't being paid. So the average weekly wage was incorrect on its face. Those are the types of things that's in that document. You'll see the document. We hope it's helpful. But if anybody has any questions or comments or suggestions about that, please give me a call. And we really do hope that it's helpful to you. And we, once again, I'm going to encourage that for those carriers who have not been part of an audit or and have not self-audited, to audit yourselves on these death benefit claims. Right now, we've initiated 24 death benefit claims. One is completed and 23 are in progress. Of the one that was completed, I'm happy to report that it looks like it was pretty consistent. It was well done. It was handled well. Next slide. Okay, so more fun stuff. The insurance carrier performance-based oversight has been completed for this year. The results were sent out last week, I believe, the 19th or the 18th, 11th, 18th. For the 2022 insurance carrier PBO, 136 insurance carriers were assessed. 41 were high tier, 82 were average tier, and 13 were poor tier. So let's break that down a little bit. Next slide. So when we're looking at overall tier results compared to past years, back to 2010, the first thing that most folks are going to notice is that the poor tier percentage of carriers that are in the poor tier has increased to 10%. The 60% of average and 30% of the of high is in line. It's still a little bit lower than we historically had. So let's dig in a little bit more to see if we can figure out what that is. Next slide. So when we look at the assessment, one of the things we look at is the initial TIBS payment. Was that initial with TIBS initiated timely? When you look at it, we have 32% in 2022 of the 136 carriers, which, by the way, is, if you notice, is more carriers than we've ever assessed before in the past. We did a pretty big jump this past year. 32%. Their score would have been low based on that on that measure, and that's much higher than in the past. Next slide. Also part of the assessment is the reporting of the initial payment measure. So we look at whether or not that the EDI was reported correctly. This is consistent. These scores are consistent over the past years. 40% were average in that reporting, 53 high. So no real change over that. Next slide. Also, we looked at medical bill processing measure, and this says these scores are consistent over the years. Next slide. And the last measure, not the last measure, but almost the last measure is the reconsideration measure. And once again, that's been pretty consistent. We didn't see any big change in that. Next slide. And then the medical bill, the reporting of medical bill. So the EDI portion, once again, consistent. So next slide. So what we didn't set, the change appears to be reflected on the number that we've had more carriers assessed than we have in the past, and the significantly higher or lower scores when it comes to the initial payment of the TIBS. So next steps, performance-based oversight's coming up next. We'll be, we start planning that 2024, 2025. For the 2024 would be the medical healthcare PBO, and 2025 would be the next carrier PBO. If you have any recommendations related to the 2024 insurance carrier or the 2025 health insurance provider, please go ahead and send those comments, recommendations to the web, to the mailbox identified. Next slide. Okay, so now we go to my next area, which is the DWC fraud and prosecutions. Just to clarify, these are fraud investigations and criminal fraud prosecutions. So these aren't administrative violations. These are criminal violations, criminal acts. Next slide. For fiscal year 23, so since September, we've had 258 fraud referrals that we received. We've opened 55 of those cases. What we do when we decide what to open is we look at the allegation itself and what has been alleged. And if the crime that has been alleged is in fact a crime and something that we have authority over, and then we make decisions whether or not to open those cases based on resources and what our priorities are. We have 13 fraud cases that we closed. So, and then we referred two for prosecution. Next slide. The same time period, we've had three convictions, one healthcare provider. The scheme for that one was a pharmacy scheme of billing for pharmacy services that were not provided. One was injured employee, which is a working and drawing scheme, working while drawing workers' compensation benefits. And one was an employer scheme, which was hiding payroll in order to reduce the cost of the workers' compensation coverage. Next slide. Enforcement date. Now, this is an update. This is our enforcement, administrative enforcement area. Next slide. So of our cases, we've had of calendar year 2022, so almost a full year, we have closed 554 cases. So let me stop here and talk about what this means. For our group, we've had a significant turnover in the administrative enforcement area. Almost every lawyer in that area has been there for less than a year. We actually have only one person who's been there a full year. We have a new manager there. She's will be there as of a year this month. And we had a significant backlog in the enforcement area. The manager, Nikki Carr, has done a great job, and the lawyers that she's hired have worked really hard to move our backlog and to have our cases move much faster. So this is congratulations to them. We have pending 344, and I know Nikki's probably going to send me a message saying it's not 344. I think it's right now, I think it's like 314. So as of today, so they're closing those cases pretty fast. Next slide. So what types of cases are pending? So those that we have open, most of those are allegations against insurance carriers, 271, and 63 for healthcare providers, and 10 other. Others, we're talking about other system participants, such as attorneys or injured employees or employers would fit into those others. Next slide. So cases closed by subject type. So we did close most of our cases. The majority of the cases that were closed were against insurance carriers, and 131 health providers and 11 others. Next slide. So what happens in our cases? So our cases, the vast majority of our cases are if it's closed with an order, those are consent orders or are agreed orders. So if you look at the 240 consent orders that were resulting from insurance carrier violations and 31 consent orders, most of the 31 were consent orders against healthcare providers, warning letters, 153 against insurance carriers, and 89 for healthcare providers. So what we're looking at when we talk about the difference between our warning letters and our consent orders is over, besides that, we're moving a lot of our older cases, which were the more difficult and challenging cases, we're moving those to resolution. So those, since they were the more challenging or egregious cases, consent orders are probably going to be the majority of those that from a warning letter. Also, we've started looking at when a warning letter is appropriate. And if we have had warning letters and issued warning letters about the same conduct over and over again, obviously that's going to be reflected in the decision whether or not an additional warning letter is appropriate. Next slide. So all our consent orders are online and they're posted on our website. And this is where you can go to find the consent orders. Next slide. So does anybody have any questions? Okay, so there are no questions. I'll go ahead and turn it over. Okay, so Kate, I don't know how we're gonna work. Are we gonna go to Joe next or? No,
Kim's gonna go ahead and give the legislative update.
Okay, cool.
Okay. So as many of you know, the Texas legislature meets every 2 years. So we're coming up quickly on the 88th legislative session. Pre-filing started on November 14th, and there's actually already been almost 1,100 bills filed. So it's been active so far. After that, we're going to be watching for January 10th at noon is when the session will kick off. and we will be watching for committees to be assigned. While we won't know for sure until the committees are assigned, I suspect that workers' compensation issues will be in House Business and Industry Committee and House Insurance Committee. On the Senate side, typically are handled in the Senate Business and Commerce or State Affairs. Another key date, if you don't mind switching the slide, Kate, is March 10th. It will be the bill filing deadline. That means that no new bills can be filed unless if it's an emergency or a local bill. And then May 29th is sine die, which is the end of regular session. Next slide, please. Another important date of note for us here at DWC is we have a legislatively required report that is due on December 1st. And that report, we provide recommendations that we think would benefit the workers' compensation system. And we also provide an update about the health of the workers' compensation system. So, and we do, that is going to publish this week on December 1st. Next slide, please, Kate. So we do have two recommendations for this year. The first is to amend the Texas tax code to exempt any medical examination or service performed to determine the appropriate level of benefits under the Texas Workers' Compensation Act from a sales and use tax. Commissioner Nelson will be talking and giving some additional background in a few moments. Next slide, please.
Hey, Kim, I'm just going to hop in right there.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
And hey, I'm sorry, I had some technical difficulties at the beginning of this. I meant to kind of give a little background on this at the beginning. So this recommendation is a result of a private letter ruling we got from the comptroller's office in October, which said DD exams are subject to state sales tax. I wanted to give a little background on how we got here, though. This has been an issue we've been working on really since February. We had a stakeholder who independently contacted the comptroller's office in February asking if DD exams were subject to sales tax. They received some informal guidance from the comptroller then stating that they believed these were like independent medical exams and therefore were subject to sales tax. And that stakeholder began charging sales tax for these exams. We quickly started getting questions about it, how we would handle it in medical and fee dispute, what our plan was. Obviously, we do not enforce the tax code. We don't interpret the tax code. So we started talking to the comptroller's office. We had several meetings with them where we laid out what a DD exam was, what its purpose was in the system, how many there are, sort of all the background on what a DD exam is. The guidance we got from them was in order to get a formal opinion from them, we would have to request a private letter ruling. So in March or April, we requested a private letter ruling from them. And that's what was issued in October, stating that they were subject to sales tax. We put that guidance out. And I think we heard a lot from people. I think the comptroller's office did too. And fortunately, we were able to work with the comptroller's office for them to issue a memo delaying implementation of the ruling until after session to give industry and us time to work on a legislative fix. So that's what this fix is here. It's going to be our number one priority. We're already in conversations with people at the Capitol. We hope it's something that you all will be able to support. And while the private letter ruling was very specific to just DD exams, it can reasonably be interpreted to apply to other types of exams like RME exams or MMIIR exams. So we plan to make a broad recommendation to exempt all of those from state sales tax, sort of just to cover our bases is why we're expanding it out so broadly. So again, we'll have the full write-up in our biennial report. That'll be issued this Thursday, but that's the background on how we got to where we are and why we were kind of had our hand forced to ask that question of the comptroller. Sorry, Kim, I'll let you.
Thank you. No, I appreciate you jumping in there. All right, next slide. And then that brings us to our second legislative recommendation, which is to amend the Texas Labor Code, Chapter 410. And what we're asking is to add a limited public information exception for working papers and electronic communications for DWC administrative law judges and the appeals panel judges. So this request is simply to provide the same protection to the DWC ALJs and appeals panel judges that is already granted to the State Office of Administrative Hearing ALJs who perform similar functions. Next slide, please. So a couple things for this session, some things that we're monitoring for. Some topics of interest are first responders and some things like expanding certain benefits like lifetime income benefits, an increase in presumption laws, or broadening the definition of first responder. Another thing is extending the COVID-19 presumption past the expiration date. So last session, y'all may recall that Senate Bill 22 created the presumption and the law is set to expire on September 1 of next year, unless there's a bill to extend it. Additionally, there could also be a bill to look at our medical guidelines and how they compare to guidelines used in other states. We have seen some bills filed for things like 24 coverage policies for work and non-related injuries, and then also work comp benefits to active duty National Guard members that are serving on the border. So those are some of the things that we are monitoring for. We are looking to forward to working with all of y'all through session, and for the next quarterly meeting, we'll have an update on what's going on in the workers' comp with respect to the legislation. Now I will turn it over, if there's no questions, to Joe McElrath to talk about the designated doctor rules.
Thank you, Kim, and good afternoon, everyone. I'd just like to update you very briefly on the designated doctor rules that we've all been working on. The first update I have is for the potential changes to Chapter 127 and 180.23, and those are the designated doctor procedures. They're really all about testing and training and the ways that you can request a designated doctor exam. We had two informal proposals of that of those rules, and we're very thankful for your feedback and recommendations. And we have a draft of that rule almost ready to post formally. And we're hoping to be able to do that in the next few weeks. When we post that informal draft, we'll also be posting updates to several forms, which we've done in the past as we've gone through rule adoption at the formal stage. We'll be updating the DWC Form 32, which is the request for designated doctor exam. And we'll also be making some minor changes to the DWC Form 67, which is the designated doctor certification application. So hopefully that package of materials will be available for you very soon. And we really would appreciate your feedback and comments on that as well. At the formal stage, it'll be posted for 30 days for comment. And after that, we're really hoping that we can move very quickly towards adoption after that process is complete. So the 127 and 180 rules included everything for designated doctors except things related to billing and reimbursement. So our billing and reimbursement rules are in chapters 133 and 134. And just last week or week before last, we posted our second informal round of changes to those rules for designated doctor billing and reimbursement. And not only does it have changes for those fees, but also we are proposing changes to fees for required medical exams and MMI and IR exams done either by a referral doctor or a treating doctor. With those materials on our website, you can also find a chart that shows the current and proposed fees to make it a little bit easier. It's the same information that's provided in the rule text, but for folks to be able to zero right in on the changes on the fees, we've also put that out for your review. And we also, in our first informal, provided some billing scenarios and examples that we're trying to show the changes to billing methodology that we were proposing in the first informal. We brought those same examples back and updated them with the new rates so that you can see the change in the methodologies as well as the rates and how they apply to those specific scenarios. And we're really hoping that that'll help you be able to digest the text changes a little bit easier and be able to provide us great comments and such. We're also on this Thursday at 1:30, we're having a presentation on the 133 and 134 rules where we'll go through the information provided and be able to answer questions and take comments from you at that time. And we hope you're able to join that for with us. And then, of course, if you're not or also would like to send us written comments, we ask that you do so by Friday, December 16th, and we will be able to evaluate those comments and bring them forward. And the last thing I wanted to say was just for all of you on the call, I've had the pleasure and the honor of working with many of you for many years, and I wanted to let you know that I miss all of you and I really appreciate everything that we've done together, and I wish you all the best in the future. So any questions about any of the designated doctor rules or anything else? Okay, great, thank you.
All right, I'm Alan Craddock. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for hearings. I'm gonna give you the hearings update, next slide. Hopefully everyone received notices that we're doing a brown bag series again. These are meetings that we did a few years ago when we were rolling out the bifurcated process to go around, get information, get thoughts from folks. When Commissioner Nelson came in and I was going over with him the hearings goals and some of the issues that we had upcoming, he asked me to get information and get input from system participants. And that's why we're doing the brown bag series again. I appreciated his want to do that, and I think you will as well. The brown bag series, we're gonna basically introduce and explain any new procedures, albeit very small, in hearings, and then also get some feedback and ideas on issues we have or even proposed procedures. The dates that we're gonna be having these, we will be in Fort Worth on January 5th. These will be from 11 o'clock until we finish, usually around lunch. You can bring your lunch with you if you want. But January 5th is Fort Worth. January 6th will be the Dallas field office. January 12th, Houston East field office. January 13th, the Houston West field office. January 19th, the Austin field office. And then we'll have a kind of a summary Zoom meeting on January 20th. To go over what input we've had and some of the ideas and thoughts. Next slide. So the updates that we do have for hearings at this point, one, for the field offices, you may have noticed that we've either removed or moved out of the way the plexiglass in the hearings rooms. We do have the availability if there's a party or someone that needs that plexiglass or wants that plexiglass put back into place. If you could just make a request a couple of days before the hearing so that we can get that moved back in. We do have the plexiglass somewhere else in the building or maybe against the wall somewhere. So if you can just let us know, we'll get that back in place. But otherwise, that will remain out of the area. Also, we have our new Austin field office at the Barbara Jordan building. Pretty fantastic office. Looks really neat. Sometimes, most of the time, the internet works. But it's going great so far today. Big thing has to do with parking. There is some street parking, but it's downtown Austin. So we've reserved some parking spaces through the state parking garage. Give us a call. Let us know you need parking. We'll get you a parking pass for the day of your hearing, or you can send an email to us at ccchparking@tdi.texas.gov. On December 19th, not anything that I think y'all will notice, but our BRCs are moving from Zoom commercial account to Zoom Gov. That's part of the process that we're required to do under state law now. By the first of the year, it's a more secure way of doing Zoom. But we are going to be moving to that on December 19th. Again, it's going to look identical to everyone here, save for and except one issue. The meeting IDs will be different. It's a different group of meeting IDs for ZoomGov. And so therefore we will update the we call PMIs with the meeting ID. So look at your BRC set notices. I know a lot of you probably already have a growing list of whose ID belongs to what bro. Those will change as of December 19th. So make sure you're watching your set notices to have those new IDs. Also, not a big change that will affect a lot of folks, but we have been doing pre-hearing MCCHs for a while. On average, we have about 20 a year. Last year, we had 12. The purpose of the pre-hearing conferences were basically to see if there were any extent of injury issues that needed to be dealt with before the MCCH, the medical contested case hearing, and then set discovery deadlines, and also just make sure that the parties, if anybody had an argument that the appeal itself was not timely filed. So we're going to eliminate, or we have eliminated the pre-hearing MCCHs, and you'll notice that the new set notices basically deal with what we did in the pre-hearing by asking the parties if there's an extent of injury issue that needs to be decided first and at least 15 days before the hearing, file a motion to abate. If a party believes that the appeal was filed late, then 15 days before the hearing, file a motion to dismiss, and then also the exchange of documents will be noted at 15 days before the hearing is to take place. So that should hopefully take care of that issue and eliminate some of the, you know, the expense that goes along with having to attend those very short hearings. Next slide. So now we're going to talk about the things that we're going to be discussing at the Brown Bag Seminars. And these are things that we want to look for ideas and input. I'm not looking for that today, obviously, but I'm going to give you a bit of a summary of it so that you can start thinking about it. So when you do attend these meetings, you'll have all of that brilliance to bring along with you. The first one has to do with, we know that there are issues with folks, you know, traveling for certain types of CCHs or hearings. You know, there's a cost that goes along with that and scheduling witnesses and such. So we're looking at ideas for more efficiency in this area. The first thing we have to look at, though, is who must attend CCHs. And the labor code tells us that all the parties shall do that, shall attend the contested case hearing. And then we have to look at, you know, well, who's a party, who subclaimants are. And then we're going to, some of the questions, though, that are outstanding would be, well, do carriers need to send a representative, for instance, to an attorney fee dispute between a claimant and their attorney? Do they need to have the expense of that? So those are some of the things that we want to get some input on. I do want to clarify, though, that right now, those that may attend by telephone, again, attending by telephone, just so everyone knows, it's a little bit, it can be problematic if you get a number of people on the phone at any given time. There's some crosstalk. There's some recording issues. And so the ALJs really have to monitor that to make the CCH run smoothly. But right now, you just need to file a motion and let the ALJ approve your motion. But you shouldn't have any problem with if a party resides out of state, witnesses appearing, non-subclaimant cases where if it looks like that the claimant is not likely to attend, then you can request to attend by telephone for the representatives, noting that if the claimant does show up, then the matter will be reset. And then subclaimant cases, if all the parties, if there's not, the big thing is testimony. If there's not gonna be any testimony, and again, the claimant is not likely to attend, then you should address that not likely to attend in your motion. But we'll set that by telephone as well. And then obviously if the claimant does show up, then we will reset that. But those are the types of ones that we're currently allowing folks to attend by telephone. So just make sure you file your motion ahead of time and get the ALJ, let them know and get their input and order. Next slide. We're also going to be talking about, you know, as of right now, we've asked parties to, it's kind of on a voluntary basis, but everybody's doing pretty good, but not sending emails directly to ALJs. and mostly to the bros. We of course had the carryover from COVID where everybody was sending a lot of stuff to the presiding officers. And we had to deal with, not that anybody in this meeting would have the problem, but we were dealing with ex parte issues, multiple copies of the same documents coming in, people filing exhibits, you know, 14 different ways and having a bunch of different versions of the documents and making sure that we were looking at the correct one in the CCH. Inappropriate conversations that were going on after the CCH because people knew the ALJ's email address, and then unsecured emails and confidential information and such. Just to keep everybody aware, the channels for sending information now, first contact the pro for the presiding officer on our website. We've got a list of the pros and each of the ALJs and the bros that they assist so that you can send the information directly to their pro and that pro will get it to the presiding officer. But otherwise, exchanges and information. We have a new way to get that to us, and that's through TextComp. If you get a login to TextComp and upload information, you can send information to us that way. Note that there are file type and size limitations for TextComp, so you can still use SFTP, and that's always a great way to get things to us. Fax, you know, again, that's 1980s technology, but we still take those, but it's a little more difficult. And of course, you're limited on the number of pages and such you can send. And then we do have some special email addresses for specifically for BRC exchanges and CCH exhibits. Next slide. Also want to talk about electronic documents. Obviously, we continue to use those. I think parties appreciate the fact that they're able to use electronic documents going forward. But we need to discuss how we're going to do that going forward. Some of the procedures that are involved, we're currently asking everybody to file early and then, you know, file exhibits 3 days prior to the hearing. But also we want to look at other efficiencies that might be able to be brought together from electronic documents and discuss these at the, and get the ideas from folks and look at maybe the some of the same procedures that the courts currently have in place for filing electronic documents about specific ways to name a document, using bookmarks, OCR. We're also looking at and want to get input on, while right now we have in the lower right-hand corner an exhibit ID, also do some sequential numbering in the lower left, and I'll talk about that here in just a second, I promise. Next slide. Want to talk about some of the practices and procedures that we have. The first one has to do with clerical errors. And some of the ways that, that we can get these taken care of. First and foremost, that parties can request these at any time, but that DWIC would look at making corrections on its own, and these are just suggestions, and we want to get your input. But DWIC would make the corrections if the error is in a finding of fact, conclusion of law, or the order itself, and the error changes the outcome. Or if there's an error in the registered agent's information, or if obviously if there's information about another claim found in the decision, that would need to be removed by us. The second practice and procedure I want to look at is, you may have noticed that we've had these quite a bit of attention put on making sure exhibits are exactly numbered and lots of other issues prior to hearings. This takes time. It takes away from the presentation of the case. And so we want to figure out a way to make sure that when we're using electronic documents that we're seeing exactly what it is that you want us to see, but also being efficient in how we go about doing that. And one of the ways that we're looking at is, I told you about sequential numbering of the exhibits in CCHs in the lower left-hand corner. What this would allow us to do is basically look at the document and say, the set of exhibits I have in front of me has 200 pages. Is that the number of pages that you want me to be seeing? And so if you have problems with, you know, exhibit numbering where it doesn't match up exactly or other issues, then, you know, you would be able to know that, well, this 200 pages that's there, that's what you meant for me to see. And then we would just be able to make that stipulation and move along. The other thing, going back to how it's been for years, and that is, look, blank and unreadable pages, that's the party's responsibility to make sure those things are what they need to be coming in because you're providing the electronic document to us. Next slide. Another big topic that Joe just got through talking about with everyone is the new procedures and that we'll need to be putting in place under the new designated doctor rules. One of the updates to the designated doctor rules will be that for non-disputed cases that involve extent of injury, MMI, and IR, designated doctors will no longer do multiple certifications. Multiple certifications are great when disputes are filed because they make sure, or at least try to make sure, that we have an adoptable rating at the time that can be argued at the CCH and at the BRC. But that's not going to be available when the new rules get put into place because, again, you know, when only 5 or 6% of cases are actually disputed, and we're seeing that, then you've got a whole lot of cases where DDs are doing multiple certifications that they don't need to. So we're going to put into place a way to get these multiple certifications at the very beginning of the dispute resolution process. And this involves a new position that we have, a Bro 1. And what the Bro 1's purpose in life will be is to identify those cases where there's extent of injury, MMI, and impairment rating cases, a dispute is filed. They will get immediately with the parties to identify extent of injury issues, whether they're claimed, accepted, or disputed. And this is where we really, really need input from the parties, because y'all may note that we have performance measures, and I think this is not a secret to anyone out there, that we have to, on average, get disputes resolved, on average, within 135 days. Well, us having to go out and get pods for these multiple certifications are going to add days to that. And as a consequence, we've got to make sure that we're very efficient at this and get this done in a manner that doesn't add time period to our performance measure. So we really want input from the parties to how is it that we can get the parties to identify these issues? How do we get claimants to tell us all of the extent of injury issues they're going to be claiming? How do we get the carriers to tell us certifications? What extent of injury issues have they accepted? Which ones are being disputed? Because once we know what those extent of injury issues are, then the Bro 1 can create and issue a pod before the first BRC and get those multiple certifications done. But we've got to really work with the parties and the designated doctors in order to expedite and get these certifications in before that first BRC so that we can work to get an agreement and then also have those in play for the parties to make their arguments. Always looking for additional ways to create efficiencies in docketing. We want to obviously promote consistent and even docketing. I think those of you that attended my state bar lecture know that I discussed the fact that last minute continuances lead to this phenomenon called clumping. At least that's what I call it. But it's for some reason, everything clumps into one day or 2 days. And so you go a couple of days without any hearings, and then all of a sudden you're filled up. And that causes problems. So we want to try and discuss ways that we can eliminate last minute continuance requests. Start evaluating if in these extent of injury, MMI, and IR disputes where we've put in place this multiple certification, getting the parties to identify extent of injury issues, which is typically what we do in the first BRC. Well, if we're doing that before the first BRC, how often are we going to need second BRCs in those cases? Can we gain some efficiencies there? We're already looking at, we're granting continuances on a case-by-case basis. It's not going to be, every continued BRC gets a 30-day reset or a 60-day reset automatically. We're looking at each case, how much time is needed in this case in order to get the information and then get back into the dispute process. So make sure that you're ready on that. And then some of the ideas, we did do a kind of a pilot brown bag seminar in San Antonio, and it was very successful. We got some great ideas, but some of the ideas that we got had to do with opening Friday dockets. And then also one of the interesting ones, again, this didn't come from me, was to create a rocket docket. And that is to, and we take that from the courts, but in the BRC, if the parties can identify that it's a simple case, that it's an average weekly wage case, or it's a simple issue case, that they could be ready with a shorter notice if a hearing date becomes available, and that we could give them three, you know, call them up and say, hey, would you be able to do this CCH in 3 days or 5 days? And then we can start filling up some of these continued cases that come out. Again, we're just now thinking about this. This was an idea that was brought up by an external participant in San Antonio, but it is interesting, and we're, you know, we're looking at that. So put that in the back of your mind, see if you have any thoughts or ideas on that. Next slide. With that, I think I'm just open to any questions. Otherwise, I will move everything quite along. All right. I think Martha Luevano, the Director of Enterprise Automation Services, is next.
Thank you, Ellen. Good afternoon, everybody. Time to wake up and talk about EDI. Is everybody out there? Anyone? I'm going to give you a brief update about the new claim standard, just kind of letting you know where we're at, and a few notes about some ongoing efforts with collecting information from carriers. So DWC and business process, we have regularly been meeting with claim EDI, key claim EDI stakeholders, such as claim administrators and vendors, our own data collection agent. We've been regularly meeting with them, and we're getting to that point where testing begins, and that begins on January 12th. So we recently met with the EDI technical group on November 10th. Most of the conversation was about getting ready for testing. But of course, that involves more than just the stakeholders that I just talked about. You know, it does involve our data collection agent. It even involves an IT project right here in-house at DWC. So the purpose of that meeting was to try to just sort of get everybody together and understand the impact of, you need to test early, you need to test often, here's our testing plan, and just kind of reinforcing the importance of the trading partners to be registered to be able to do that starting on January 12th. So we did record that session. I don't know if anybody would be interested in watching that session, but the link is right there on the page. If anyone is having trouble sleeping, you might want to go there. You might remember some of that information and also get a good night's rest. So one of the other topics I wanted to talk about is that me and my staff are making ourselves available to give orientations to anybody who has questions, anybody who is uncomfortable, anybody who has kind of nervousness around the new claims EDI standard. And this is regardless of whether it's, you know, adjusters or a team of adjusters, sorry, lights went out, or carriers, or, you know, technical folks. We are here to give either orientations or to set up specific meetings to talk about topics and questions. We can customize those meetings. So if anybody needs our help, please give me an email. Let me know what you need. Let me know if there's somebody in your organization that maybe needs a little bit of help understanding where things are even for the claim EDI standard. So that's what I have for claims EDI. Next slide. Okay, so seems like I'm getting into a habit of thanking you all for something and then asking you for something else. So first of all, I would like to thank everybody on this call for their cooperation with updating the claim administrative contact information in TexComp. This was a humongous task. There was a lot of, you know, kind of good information, bad information in there. And I certainly appreciate the carrier representatives and their patience with my staff, you know, kind of going after that information and getting what they needed. So I thank you all very much. And I will kind of take this opportunity to remind you that if there are any changes within your carrier organizations, that those need to be reported timely because that claim administrative contact information is for the benefit of the public, for them to be able to reach the departments, the different departments and areas for your organization. So that's a thank you, and here's the ask. there are some EDI claim in compliance coordinator forms that we have not received from certain carriers. So staff is right now, probably might have already gotten an email or a phone call from staff asking if you will follow up with your carriers on filing the EDI-03 that we have not received yet. So again, this is something that's connected to testing. We would like to have all of those received from each and every carrier that's going to test by January 12th as well. So, and also as a reminder, the individual that is selected by the carrier to be the compliance coordinator for claim EDI and medical for that fact, must be an employee of the carrier and cannot be an employee of the TPA or the vendor. And I think that is all I have for my update. Are there any questions? All right, thank you. And I believe I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Nelson. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you all again for attending. I'm sorry about those technical issues I had again. I will say when we scheduled this meeting, we did not know it was going to be in the middle of the USA World Cup game. But I am happy to say that we just won that game. So it was 1-0. So we won. We're moving on. A few little things I did just want to mention at the end here. Alan had a lot he went over for hearings. A lot of those are just ideas right now that have been brought to us from external parties and also some ideas that we've come up with internally. I would really try to attend at least one of those brown bag meetings that we're trying to hold in various places around the state to make it easy for you all. But he does have a lot of good ideas, but we are definitely looking for input at those meetings. Like he said, we're really trying to find ways to speed up our dispute resolution process, not only because we do have a performance measure given to us from the legislature that is important for us, but I also think it's just important for all the parties involved to get these disputes resolved as quickly as possible. So that's really part of the reason we're working on those. Also, you know, Deborah went over some good information on PBO. You know, please take a look at that. I think the accuracy of TIBS payments is a little how it's consistently gotten less accurate. I think it's something we're going to be digging into to see why that is. But that is a little bit concerning, especially when we tell you when PBO is going to be and what we're going to be looking at in advance. So, you know, you all may want to just take a close look at your results and see where you stack up in those. And then lastly, on our staff changes, I didn't really get to mention it, but, you know, Joe McElrath, he's retiring at the end of the year, and Matt Zurich recently retired at the end of October. They were two really key staff members I know a lot of you all work with closely. They not only impacted the agency a lot, but they impacted the whole workers' comp system. We were very sad to see them go or have them announce they're leaving, but we're very fortunate that they developed very strong staff behind them. They have very strong program areas and have people who've been able to step in and will do a great job. So we're excited to have, you know, Tammy replace Joe and have Mary already step in to replace Matt. So I think we're very lucky where I don't think some other agencies would have that deep of a bench who could step in right away. So I think we're very lucky there. And one other person who wasn't available on this call, she's at a holiday meeting at another agency, is Erica De La Cruz. She is the new deputy commissioner of claims customer services. A lot of you may know her. She's been with DWC since 2005 in various roles. She's really been leading our customer service efforts since 2017. She's made a lot of really good changes. You know, just one small thing. For example, she created a virtual call center. So all of our claims customer service around the state are able to answer calls from all one call center. And she's gotten wait times down from about 3 minutes down to about 16 seconds. That's all in English and Spanish. And she's done a lot of things like that. So we're lucky to have her. She's already been doing a great job. And I know she would have liked to have been here to introduce herself, but she's doing great too. And this is last call for any questions. If anyone has any questions, comments about anything we went over today. All right. Well, thank you for attending.
Thank y'all.
All right.